Hey, good morning, everybody. This is BIOS 231, and it is October 20th, and we're going to take a look at a schedule really soon. Morning. There. Okay, BIOS 231, October 20th. We can just put it right there. News from SI, no news except that there is no SI session today, but on Wednesday, resume normal schedule, BUS 310, Business 310, and, what time is it at? 12:15, right after class. Okay, so let's take a look at the schedule first. So today is the 20th. What do we have to do today? All right, we're going to start central nervous system. Oh, maybe I didn't finish something. I just remember, maybe I didn't finish something in the introductory chapter on nervous system. All right, so here's the 20th. Let's just take a look at the schedule before I find those other materials. So the next lecture exam is 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks away from today, and it's going to be on a Monday. But there's no practicum on that Monday, but nonetheless, it's going to be on a Monday, November 17th. You'll have completed a third practicum by that time, because your third practicums are going to either be on the 3rd or 5th of November. And so we have today's lab and next week's lab. So today and next week, and then the practicum after that. So we're going to finish up muscles and lab, and then next week is kind of special because we're going to start dissection. So we're going to do eyeballs and brains next week. So when we do dissections, you need hand protection and eye protection. Make sure that you get that started right away. So any kind of safety glasses will work, or regular glasses that you have if they're big enough. If you wear contact lenses, for sure get safety glasses. They do not need to be the big fancy chemistry goggles. But those are okay. But just some kind of safety glasses to protect your cornea. If you want to bring a mask, that's fine. And a coat, lab coat or lab shirt to put on so you don't get eyeball juice on your clothes. Or, for instance, when you cut into an eyeball, sometimes a bunch of fluid squirts out because it's kind of high pressure. And if you're talking at the same time, then that eyeball fluid will squirt in your mouth. So if you want to bring a mask, that's fine. It won't protect you from some of the chemicals that evaporate that we preserve the specimens in. Those aren't terribly dangerous anymore because it's mostly alcohol, but nonetheless, we don't want all that alcohol and eyeball juice squirting into your mouth. So a mask is pretty good. The syllabus outlines some good materials that you should use, like the combination mask and visor. Those are really nice. It folds flat. Okay, anybody got a question on the schedule? Let's take a look. What are the chapters on the next test? 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Ooh, does that leave anything at all for the last chapter? Oh, yeah, it does. Okay. Thank goodness. So let me see. I got to go back to chapter 12. Okay. Well, nonetheless, don't forget this scheme that's in your notes. When we talk about nervous system, I want you to figure out what we're talking about and place it into this diagram so that it makes perfect sense for you. All right, so we talked about different cells, talked about a synapse. Oh, we didn't talk about an action potential just yet. So I think that's where we're going to start. Okay. So remember, how many different kinds of cells make up nervous tissue? Yeah. I heard two, that's right. And what are their names? We got neurons, and we have neuroglia, or support cells. And remember, it's the job of the neurons to send electrical impulses very quickly through long distances in your body. That's their main function. They send electrical impulses. Support cells don't send electrical impulses. They just help neurons do their job. Maybe it directs them how to connect up to each other to form a network, or different barriers in the brain, like the blood-brain barrier. So since neurons have these electrical properties, I do want you to know just a couple little things. We're not going to look in a lot of detail, but Every cell has what we call a resting membrane potential. And potential just means a voltage. And that voltage exists from the inside of the cell to the outside of the cell, and it's just separated by the plasma membrane. And I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of things that have voltage. There are two places, and there's a difference in electrical charge in these two different places. I'm sure you have some of these things in your pocket. What are these things? That store a separation in charge, store a difference in voltage between two places. Right? And since they're electrical charges, this might help you answer that question. If they're electrical charges, they're either plus or minus. And what's the relationship between plus and minus in a sense? Do they attract each other or do they oppose each other? And they do attract each other, right? So negative charges just love to go to positive, or you could think of it positive charges just love to go to negative, and then they become neutral. That's a very stable situation. So if you have one of these devices in your pocket that separates charge out, what are those charges just wanting to do? They're wanting to meet up with each other, right? Or flow from one area to another to become neutral. So what do we call that device that you have in your pocket? Just, I'm sure everybody does, right? That has a difference in charge, and if you hook it up, if there's a current that goes through them, okay? There are ions. Yeah, you have ions in your pocket. We're going to talk about those in a second. But what you have in your pocket are batteries. Oh, I have a battery in my watch right here, right? So every cell in your body acts like a battery because there's a separation in charge. And as a result, the cell can do work, just like a battery can do work. And what happens if you have a battery and there's no difference in electrical charge between the two terminals? Well, what do you call that battery, especially if it's in your car? It's a dead battery, right? So a dead battery, there's no separation in charge. There's no energy left in it to do any kind of work. The same thing for a cell. If there's no electrical charge difference between the inside and outside of the cell, what can we say about that cell? It is dead as well. Okay, so it needs that electrical charge. You don't have to know what it is, but I have it in your notes, about minus 70 millivolts. And it is due to two different ions. And I do want you to know the chemical symbol for just two of these elements in the periodic table. Na stands for, who can shout it out? Sodium. Yeah, Na is sodium, and you can see it has an electrical charge. And here is K. What is K? Potassium. That's right. So that N doesn't look at all like sodium, right, because sodium is an S, but S is sulfur, so we got to call it something else. And the same thing for potassium. P is phosphorus, so potassium needs a different letter, and so we call that K. All right, so that's the resting membrane potential. It has to do with these ions. They're different concentration across the membrane, and that develops this resting membrane potential. But when the neuron is stimulated, then it's no longer at rest. It can produce something that is and a voltage that is moving. We call that an action potential. Here's what I want you to know about an action potential. Right. It's the way that neurons transmit information from one part of its cell to another, and it only has two parts. An action potential only has two parts. There's a depolarizing part and then a repolarizing part. The depolarization is due to sodium entering the cell. So I think you just have to memorize that. In physiology, you get to understand why that all happens, but I do want you to be looking forward to physiology, and here's one reason. Depolarization is sodium entering the cell, and repolarization is not sodium, but potassium leaving the cell. So if you're going to just highlight a couple things for action potential, depolarization, sodium enters the cell. For repolarization, potassium leaves. All right, so for these electrical properties, there are two ions that are very important. What are the two ions? Sodium and potassium. That's great if you know that. And we know that they're ions because they have this electrical charge, right? Both of them are positive. And so that makes them an ion. But sometimes in medicine, we give them another name. sometimes maybe you'll be working in the emergency room and somebody's going to draw some blood and they're going to hand you this blood in the syringe and say, run down to the lab, get some lights on this right away. And so what do you do when you hear that term? Get some lights on this right away. Going to go look for flashlights or big floodlights or something? No. Those kind of lights, L-Y-T-E-S stands for electrolytes. These are particles that have electrical charge on them, like sodium and potassium, magnesium. These things have to be in the correct balance for somebody to be healthy, right? So just remember, every cell acts like a battery, produces that resting membrane potential. An action potential is a way that a cell can send information fast over long distances. Has two parts, depolarization and repolarization. And depolarization is due to sodium entering the cell. Repolarization is potassium leaving the cell. Right? And that event just travels over the whole neuron. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about an action potential and why nerves can transmit information. All right, before we get to the next chapter, I want to go over some terms. But you know what? I didn't ask anybody if they had a question. This might be really strange for you to think about, that every cell and your body acts like a battery. You probably never thought of yourself as being that electrical, but you are very electrical beings because of all these different ions or electrolytes in your body. Anybody have any questions about that? No? Okay, kind of freaky stuff, but very important. You don't want any dead batteries in your body, right? Okay. All right, some terms. Some of these terms maybe we've talked about already. Gray matter versus white matter. There is something that makes neurons look white. What is something that makes neurons look white? It is myelin, right? And it's going to be on axons. So if there's an axon that's myelinated, it's going to appear white. And there's another part of the neuron that is never myelinated, and so it looks gray. What part of the neuron is never myelinated? It is the dendrite and cell body. So if there is a group of axons with myelin sheaths, we call that white matter. But if there's a cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, of course they're not myelinated, we're going to call that gray matter. Gray matter and white matter, two groupings of different parts of a neuron. Okay, in the central nervous system, that's what CNS stands for, and in the cortex, ooh, what does cortex mean once again? Everybody knows what cortex means. What does cortex mean? It's a part of an organ. What part is it? Anybody remember? As opposed to medulla. Okay, cortex, brain, but you know what? The kidney has a cortex. The adrenal gland has a cortex. Bone has a cortex. It is the superficial part of any organ is the cortex. Superficial. It's the part that's on the surface. And so what's the deep part called? Just use your knowledge of a bone even. What's the deep part called? The medulla, right? So organs we can break down into cortex and medulla. And a lot of times there's a big difference between what we find in the cortex and the medulla, and the brain is no different. All right, so in the cortex, the superficial part, we have gray matter that's on the surface of the brain. So what do you have on the surface of the brain? You have nerve cell bodies and dendrites, okay? Not axons. And if we have a group of these nerve cell bodies and dendrites that is not in the cortex, but it's deep inside the brain, we're going to call that a nucleus. All right, so you can have gray matter deep inside the brain. This is going to be a special cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. We're going to call that a nucleus. All right, so a nucleus means a whole bunch of different things. It could be the nucleus of an atom, the nucleus of a cell, but in this case, a nucleus is just going to be a dark area inside, deep inside the brain. So there can be a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that is not in the central nervous system, but it's in the peripheral nervous system. We don't want to call that a nucleus. We want to call that a ganglion. So where do you find ganglia? In the peripheral nervous system. And where do you find nuclei? In the central nervous system. And what could you tell me about nuclei and ganglia? Do they share anything in common? Well, they're almost exactly alike because they're just made up of a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. right? And not myelinated axons. That's the big difference. All right, so white matter we talked about. Then the only thing we got to know is the difference between a tract and a nerve. A nerve is something we find in the peripheral nervous system, and a tract is something we find in the central nervous system. That's a lot like nuclei and ganglia, right? So again, a tract is white matter, and that's only in the central nervous system. So a tract is what, since it's white matter? What part of a neuron is it? It's an axon, right? And it's myelinated. And so it's just an axon that's carrying information really rapidly between long distances inside the brain or spinal cord. That's a tract. That same kind of thing is going to be white matter in the peripheral nervous system, but we're just going to call that a nerve. So where do you find nerves? In the peripheral nervous system. And where do you find tracts? In the central nervous system. But in both cases, they're going to be myelinated axons. So you could think of these as being bundles of wires going someplace. And remember, electrical signals can only go in one direction, and that's from dendrite, cell body, down an axon. So electrical signals can't go axon, cell body, dendrite. It just doesn't work that way. So you need two different cells if you want information going in two different directions. Nerve impulse. Oh, I'm almost positive we talked about that. Why do neurons have myelinated axons? Or what's the result of having a myelinated axon compared to a non-myelinated axon? What does a myelinated do? It's fast. Yeah, it speeds up the rate of that action potential zipping down that axon, right? And when it is skipping down an axon fast, we call that saltatory conduction. Saltatory is very fast. It could be at hundreds of miles per hour. That'd be cool to be able to run that fast, to get to school really quick. Okay, saltatory conduction, hundreds of miles an hour. But if an axon is not myelinated, right, it's only about 2 miles an hour. You can walk faster than that. So that's very slow. So what do you think is better, faster or slower? Faster, sure, faster. Faster responding nervous system is much better. So myelinated nerve fibers are much better than non-myelinated nerve fibers. They're more of a recent development and evolution, while the non-myelinated neurons are more ancestral in terms of evolution. Okay, so we're not going to look at a tract right now, but in the next chapter we will, because that's central nervous system. But let's look at a nerve. Let's find a nerve. And a nerve is going to remind you of how a muscle is put together. Okay, what is the building block of a muscle? Okay, building block of a whole muscle, like the biceps brachii. What's the basic building block? It's got a lot of steps, all right? These things, I think you can even see with your naked eye. Okay, what do you have? And these things can be broken down into nerve cells. So if we add a bunch of nerve cells together, what do we get that makes up a muscle? You get a fascicle. That's right. So bundles of cells are what we call fascicles. Right? And remember, in a muscle, there's connective tissue that separates out fascicles from each other. And then if you look even more closely, you see that every cell has connective tissue around it. And then, of course, the whole muscle itself has connective tissue around it. Same thing for a nerve. So here we have a structure, and I even see that this thing has blood vessels. And this is a nerve. And where the heck are we going to find this thing? In the central nervous system or peripheral? Peripheral nervous system. Like when you bang your elbow onto something and you feel an electric jolt, this is the thing that you're crushing, right, and stimulating electrical events in all these different nerve fibers. All right, so surrounding the whole nerve is what we call the epineurium. And then if we look on the inside, of course, we see some structures, and these structures are fascicles, and the connective tissue that surrounds a bunch of these axons is what we call the perineurium. And So a perineurium contains many axons that are going someplace. They're maybe taking impulses down to the periphery or maybe bringing signals back into the central nervous system. But in each, if that was the case, then there has to be at least two different neurons oriented in different directions. Remember, because electrical signals only go in one direction. And then surrounding every axon is the endoneurium. So you got epi, peri, and endoneurium, pretty much just like what we saw in muscles. And is this a myelinated axon? Yeah, because I can see, oh, what are these cells right here? You should know these cells. Those are Schwann. Not oligodendrocytes?
No.
Because why? Yeah, oligodendrocytes are in the central nervous system. Ooh, and that's going to take us right to the next chapter, central nervous system. Okay, so since these axons are really long and narrow, sometimes we call these neurons a nerve fiber, just like a skeletal muscle cell. So here is a fiber, nerve fiber, the axon, and it's myelinated. And then surrounding the myelin is the endoneurium. Put a bunch of nerve fibers together, we get a fascicle. Connective tissue surrounding a fascicle is the perineurium. And if we put a whole bunch of fascicles together, right, we get a nerve as long as we surround it with the epineurium. Now there's two other things that we see in a nerve. Because it needs nourishment, it needs oxygen, needs to get rid of waste products like carbon dioxide. Look what I have right here. We have blood vessels. So in big nerves, they even have their own blood vessels. And that's something we do not see with tracts. We don't see all the connective tissue associated with tracts as well. And where would you, if I wanted you to show me a tract, where would we start looking? In the central nervous system. Yeah, it's going to look white. All right, so what else do we want to talk about? Basic organization, we talked about that already. The only thing we didn't talk about, different ways of processing information, all this other stuff we talked about already. So how can we process information? Let's take a look at these things. Got three different ways. All right, so on this slide, I only see neurons, and as a matter of fact, they all have only one kind of shape. What kind of shape do we see of all these neurons? But I tell you what, before you think of that, how many different shapes of neurons did we learn about?
Three.
Yeah, and here's one of them. And this is it's a really nice multipolar neuron, right? It's not pseudo-unipolar, it's not unipolar, not bipolar, so it's a multipolar neuron with a bunch of dendrites, one cell body, and one really long axon. All right, so sometimes signals are processed by diverging. So here is a single neuron, and it sends an electrical impulse. Ooh, what do we call that thing that's being sent? Is it a resting membrane potential? It is not. It is an action potential because it's something in motion. So that electrical thing that's in motion, which is an action potential, moves down an axon, but it doesn't go just to one cell. What happens to it? It splits and goes to three different locations. So here is that one signal we see diverging to numerous locations. And even then, that second row of cells can bifurcate once again and send information to two different locations. All right, and each of these secondary cells sends information to more than one location. So just by stimulating one neuron, many, many other neurons can be stimulated as well, right? So that information is shared. That's a good way of thinking of a diverging circuit, a sharing of information, right? The opposite can be true. Here we see, let's look at just one cell once again, but instead of on the top, we're going to look at the bottom on this illustration. Here is a cell that is going to send information, and this cell is receiving information from 1, 2, 3 other cells. All right, so here, this output cell is getting information from these three different sources, and the output neuron then is adding all of that information together. We call that integration. So a converging circuit integrates information to make sense out of your world. Can anybody think of an example of maybe a convergent system in your body? How about if I hear a fire alarm right now? That's one kind of signal entering my body. What are you going to do? What is this output neuron going to do when you hear a fire alarm? You're going to run out of the building, right? Maybe screaming or something. Probably not so drastic as that, but you're going to leave the building. Okay, so that's number one. You hear the fire alarm. Okay, and then let's think of a second condition. You hear the fire alarm, and then you see a flashing light, right? Because all the lights go out, and then the power backup system comes on. So you hear the fire alarm and the flashing light. All right, and so what is this output neuron going to decide to do? Run out of the building once again, because there's nothing, because you're for sure, right, that there's a fire someplace. Now this third neuron right here, how about if right before the fire alarm goes off, we get a message, and the message says, we're just testing the fire alarms. There's not a fire, so if you hear a fire alarm and flashing lights, you don't have to run out of the building. So you hear the fire alarm, you see the flashing lights, you have that other information. What is this neuron going to do? You're going to just stay in place, right, and listen to lecture. So that's integrating all of that information together. How about if we just throw one more neuron in here? How about if all of a sudden you hear the message, don't leave the building, you hear the fire alarm, you see the flashing light, but you also get some olfactory information, that smell, and you smell smoke. Now what is this neuron going to do? You're going to run out of the building, right? So converging circuits integrate information up from hundreds of different places in your body, okay? All right, so divergence is sharing, converging is integration. Then the last kind over here is what we call reverberating circuit. So here is the input neuron bringing information in. Here's the output neuron. And we see that there's a series of neurons. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4 neurons. The input is number 1, output is number 4. But let's look at number 3. When 3 gets stimulated, do you see this diverging circuit right here? It not only stimulates neuron number 4, but what happens? It stimulates another neuron that is pointing in the opposite direction, so that this impulse goes back and stimulates the cell that is stimulating this one that it's going backwards. Not only that, but this one also stimulates number 2, right? And so then what happens? So when number 2 gets stimulated, that stimulates 3, which does what? Re-stimulates 3 and re-stimulates 2, which does what? Goes back, re-stimulates 2 and 3. And furthermore, let's look at this output neuron. When the output neuron gets stimulated, right, it sends signals backward to re-stimulate neurons 2 and 3, and this process can go on and on and on and on until these neurons fatigue. Can you think of an example of maybe where there's a reverberating circuit? Anybody think of? I'll give you a hint. How about when you hear an alarm clock in the morning? What happens to you? Under most circumstances. Well, you wake up, and then, okay, once you wake up, these reverberating circuits then are activated, and then you maintain consciousness or arousal for a long period of time because there are reverberating circuits that keep you awake during the day, right? And then, of course, they can't go on forever because they fatigue, and then what happens when they fatigue? Yeah, then you fall asleep once again, okay? All right, so if these reverberating circuits aren't working properly, then somebody might have a tendency to fall asleep all the time. And I think you probably know what that condition is called. What condition is that? That could be narcolepsy. Okay, narcolepsy, when people just fall asleep. And that narcolepsy is due to this neuronal defect. Sometimes it's really hard to diagnose. Of course, there might be other conditions that make you fall asleep during the day, and that is if you can't sleep at night. And there's a really serious kind of common condition where people can't sleep solidly, soundly all night long, and that would be caused by sleep apnea. Yeah, so sleep apnea doesn't have anything to do with these reverberation circuits, but it's due to other kinds of things like airway obstruction or something like that. Okay, so put arousal down for reverberating circuit. And does that make sense? Yeah, I think that should make sense. Okay, disorders of the nervous system. I talked about multiple sclerosis already in terms of the demyelinating process that happens during that disease. All right, so that's it for introductory chapter. And unless there's a question, is there a question so far? We're good. All right, so I'll put these away. And then move on to central nervous system. And what we're going to do, I'll put that away. What happened? Let's go back. Okay. Well, I tell you what. We got to define what central nervous system is. Who can tell me what central nervous system is? I sort of see it here. I like it. Yeah, I like it. It's brain and spinal cord. And that's pretty much what I see here, just a little piece of the brain. And so where I want to start the lecture first is up here within the brain. And then we're going to talk about spinal cord a little bit later. And we'll talk about it by their particular location. So where is a good picture of the brain? A lot of good pictures. Okay, who knows what's on the quiz for next week? It's that one. 13, 14. It's gone. You see it? Ah, 18. No, that's not it. Too much. Here. Okay. Okay, so here we have a picture of central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. Is that true? No, you're right, because here is the brain. And that brain comes down to right about here, and then below that is spinal cord. So brain and spinal cord is central nervous system. Maybe you can see a change in color, right? I can see some darker color up over here, and then a lighter color for the spinal cord. And this is where the central nervous system changes between brain and spinal cord, and that's exactly at the foramen magnum within the occipital bone. Right, so everything superior to that is brain, everything inferior to that is spinal cord. So let's look at brain first. Going superior from the foramen magnum, this first bump is what we call the medulla oblongata. And the medulla oblongata is part of, also when the pons is joined with it, we call this the brain stem, because all the other parts of the brain, right, stem from the medulla and the pons. Right, they get signals. All right, so here is the medulla, and the function of the medulla we see right here. Heart rate. Can you control your heart rate? No. What about constriction of blood vessels? For instance, when you're hot, blood vessels in your skin dilate, or when you're cold, they vasoconstrict. Is that under your conscious control? No. What about vomiting? Nope, that's not under conscious control. I suppose you can trick yourself. Swallowing, part of it is under involuntary control. After you swallow something about a third of the way down, then you no longer can stop that process. Right? So swallowing is involuntary. Coughing and sneezing, there are involuntary parts to both of these. So there's a lot of involuntary processing or control of organs in your body within the medulla. So this is the oldest part, most ancestral part of the brain. So anything that has a brain has this area right here for automatically controlling blood pressure, breathing, heart rate, all of that kind of stuff. So sometimes we even consider this the reptilian brain. So we do have a reptilian brain that is in the brain stem. Okay, so there are nuclei in this area for processing that information, and so can you tell me what a nucleus is once again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Right. Okay. Right above the medulla, the second bump right here is what we call the pons. And the pons is associated, it has some centers that work with the centers in the medulla for respiration and the cardioregulatory center for regulating your heart rate. But there's another function of the pons that we're going to see in just a second. And this is just right, well, I tell you what kind of section are we looking at right here? Is this a transverse, coronal, or sagittal? Sagittal, right. And as a matter of fact, this is a nice mid-sagittal section, right? Going right smack down through the middle of the brain. All right, so we can't see laterally, but the pons also wraps around as it moves laterally and moves into the cerebellum. All right, so there are tracts that go through the pons that end up in the cerebellum. We're going to talk about the cerebellum, but cerebellum is important for maintaining balance or posture. That's one of the important things about the cerebellum. Cerebellum is not part of the brainstem. It's just a part of the brain all by itself. And can you see white matter? Yeah. And can you see gray matter? Yeah, it's just right on the surface. So this white matter is, what would you call this white matter? The tract or nucleus? It's tract, yeah. It's information going someplace. And what do you have in all these different darker areas? That is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. I wouldn't really call that a nucleus. I'll show you a nucleus in just a little bit. But nonetheless, it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites right on the surface of the cerebellum. Okay. Also, part of the brain stem is this area right here. Do you see like two little bumps? Almost looks like a little camel hump right here. All right, but now orient superior and inferiorly, there are two bumps. There's two on the right, two on the left. So there are four of these little bodies. They're called the corpora quadrigemina. Right? Four little bodies. They have different functions. There's gray matter in there, so there's special processing power. So each one is called a colliculus of the corpora quadrigemina. Here is the superior colliculus, and then down below it is the inferior colliculus. Right? And you see that they have different functions. The superior colliculus allows a number of visual reflexes to take place. It allows you to fix your gaze on an object and track it as it moves in space. Right? It's due to the superior colliculus. So if I were to wad up a piece of paper and throw it at you, you could tell where that piece of paper was going, if it's going to curve out of the way or go over your head or curve the other way or drop down, because the superior colliculus right here will fix your gaze on that object and then figure out where it's going to end up to a large degree. And with practice, that can be really, really, you can get really, really good at that. Who's really, really good at that? Being able to track something as it's curving around or dipping or raising up. Like a baseball player, yeah, their superior colliculus is really advanced. I'm sure they have specific tests for that. They just test to see how everybody's superior colliculus is. Okay, and you have no consciousness about what that object is, okay, if it's there or not. It just is an area that moves your eyes around so that it can track an object. That's its whole thing. Okay, it can't describe what the object is, the color, or anything like that. It just can see that it's an object and that it's in motion. The inferior colliculus is not involved with vision, but it's involved with hearing. And in particular, we say localization of sound. So when you hear something, you can tell where the sound is coming from. And that's because you have two ears. They're not exactly located in the same place. So if there's sound coming from my right, guess what ear hears it first? My right ear hears it first, and then my left ear. And because of that really short time difference, right, this inferior colliculus can tell the sound came from my right. And it's really good at that. So we have four doors in this room. And if with my eyes closed, if you were to open and close one door, do you think I would be able to tell what door was opening and closing? Yeah, right? Try that. It's probably just a little thinking experiment. It's really easy to tell, right? And that's due to the inferior colliculus, right? That's part of the brain stem as well, right? Okay, the inferior colliculus, along with this part of the brain, this is what we call the This is what we're going to call a bridge between the pons and medulla and the cerebrum. Here's the cerebrum. It's the largest part of the brain. And that bridge has got a really funny name. It's called a peduncle. A peduncle is a bridge between major parts of the brain. So there's a lot of signals that have to pass back and through this peduncle. And since it's going to the cerebrum, we call that the cerebral peduncle. Peduncle is a bridge. And remember, I said that part of the job of the pons was to bring information into the cerebellum and vice versa. There are peduncles as well that bring information from the pons into the cerebellum. Those bridges are peduncles as well, but we don't call those the cerebral peduncles. Those would be the cerebellar peduncles, right? And remember, just peduncle is a bridge. That's the best way to think of it. All right. Associated with the pons and the medulla, right in this region here, are reverberating circuits that will keep you awake during the day. Those accumulations of reverberating circuits, partly in the pons and partly in the medulla, are what we call the reticular activating system, or RAS. Reticular activating system is shared between the pons and the medulla, as are a lot of other kinds of functions, like the cardioregulatory center and breathing center, right? So the reticular activating system is not a particular structure like the pons, medulla, corpora quadrigemina, but it's just a special area that's shared between the pons and the medulla. And that, okay, maintains a nice wakeful state. So if we were to, so that's all brainstem. The rest of the brain sits on top of this. If we think of the cerebral peduncle, which is right here, and the corpora quadrigemina, we can see that it's pretty much right smack in the middle of the brain, and so that area we call the midbrain. Midbrain is the bridge and these other special processing centers for vision and hearing. All right, so we got medulla, the pons, peduncle, corpora quadrigemina. Nice. All right, the diencephalon. Diencephalon is above it. And I see it right here. The diencephalon is made up of something that looks like a little walnut. And this is the thalamus. And there's a little sliver of space between the right and left lobes of the thalamus. And then here is a bridge between them. And we could maybe call this an infundibulum. A peduncle. But in this case, we just call it an adhesion, interthalamic adhesion. This is where the two sides of the thalamus are joined together. And then this area right below the thalamus is what we call the hypothalamus. That should make pretty good sense to you. So you got thalamus and hypothalamus. But I do want you to know some functions of the hypothalamus and the thalamus. Right, the job of the thalamus is that it receives sensory information. What's another word for sensory? I think we looked at that. Another word for is afferent. Yeah, you should probably say afferent, but I'll say afferent to make sure that you know I'm saying an A. Afferent. And which way do afferent signals go? From above to below or from below to above? All right, they're bringing information into the central nervous system or into the cerebrum. Right, so the job of the thalamus is to receive sensory information, and then it will direct that sensory information to the correct part of the cerebral cortex. All right, so we're going to learn some different lobes of the cerebral cortex. They're going to receive action potentials that we just talked about, electrical information, and depending on what part of the cerebral cortex is stimulated, you will have a different sensation. Right, so what are some sensations? Well, you can hear things, right? And they go to an area kind of right by your ear, as a matter of fact, the temporal lobe. Right? You can see things. They're going to go way back over here. This is the occipital lobe. That should make sense because what bone is back over here? Occipital bone. This is the area for vision. So it's the job of the thalamus to receive those signals and make sure that they're directed to the correct part of the brain so that you perceive the correct information. So for instance, if your eye, your retina, was wired to your temporal lobe, which is used for hearing, right? When light was shining on your retina, what would be your experience if those action potentials go to the temporal lobe? In particular, the primary auditory cortex. If those signals from your eyes went to the temporal lobe, then you would actually experience sound of some kind, right? So it's the area of the brain that gives you the sensation. It's a job of the thalamus to make sure those signals get to the proper location. How about if we have some nerves from your nose and the thalamus redirects them into the occipital lobe, maybe by accident? What would be your sensation? Instead of smelling something, when you smelled something, you would experience some kind of visual experience, because that's the part of the brain that it's going to. So it's the part of the brain that determines what the sensation is. All right, so that's the job of the thalamus. So that's a pretty important job. The hypothalamus is really important because there are thermoreceptors in the hypothalamus that can tell if your body temperature is too hot or too cold. Or if you have an infection, it will reset what your normal body temperature is to make it warmer, right? So your body temperature just naturally increases. And there are senses for thirst and hunger. That all happens in the hypothalamus. And not on your list, but it also controls some important endocrine glands. It controls the pituitary, right? So it has some very important endocrine functions, and the pituitary controls many other kinds of endocrines in your body. And the pituitary is controlled by the hypothalamus. That's maybe a good way of looking at that. So thalamus and hypothalamus are part of the diencephalon. All right, so now let's look at the cerebrum. Cerebrum is above, right, the diencephalon. And I'm looking at the surface of the cerebrum. The cerebrum can be broken down into two main parts, a right part and a left part. We call those the cerebral hemispheres. And what part are we looking at right now? We're looking at the right cerebral hemisphere. And then when I look at the surface of the cerebrum, does it look flat and smooth, or does it look all wrinkled up? Yeah, it's all wrinkled up. The wrinkling appearance is given a name. It's called a convolution. All these folds in the surface of the brain are called convolutions. And of course, a convolution then has two parts to it, right? You see this dark area here and this lighter area here? That just represents that the light area is the raised or high part, and this dark area is the depressed region, right? That makes that fold. So the high region is what we call a gyrus, and the depression is what we call you've used this term in terms of bones already, that's a sulcus. Okay, so what do we have? What do we call all these folds in the brain? You have a gyrus followed by a sulcus, followed by a gyrus, followed by a sulcus, followed by a gyrus, followed by a sulcus, right? So everything is just folded up. Now, why do we have these folds in the cerebral? Now, is this the medulla or the cortex, the superficial part of the cerebrum? Yeah, cortex. Why do we have all these convolutions in the surface of the cortex? Because the processing power of a brain, right, means actually you could think of the intelligence of a brain is related to the surface area, how big the brain is right on the cortex. So we would have to have, we're very intelligent beings. Our cortex has to be big, right? But then it wouldn't fit inside of our skull and inside of our cranium. So what has evolution figured out to do? Take a big surface area, put it in a small space. What do? You crinkle it up. You put those folds, and now it fits into a really small space. All right, so humans have a lot of convolutions. Other animals, like what other kinds of snakes, elephants, don't have nearly the same kind of convolutions, right? Because their brains aren't necessarily big in terms of the cerebral cortex and processing power. Okay, so that's a convolution. Remember, it's made up of two parts. The lobe in the front, there are a couple lobes that we're going to look at. The lobe in the front right here, named after the bone that is right underneath, which is the frontal bone. And then posterior to that, what bone do you have? The parietal. So here's the parietal lobe. When I'm looking at a nice sagittal view, I can't see a nice separation between parietal and frontal, but in a lateral view, we'll see that it's really obvious. Right? And then what lobe of the brain is this? We talked about this already. That is the occipital lobe. Right? So occipital lobe is, I think you should just put down vision. That would be good, vision, the sense of vision. Okay. Let me find another view of the cerebrum. Another nice view of the cerebrum would be, here's another nice view. Here's a picture of a human brain. So here's anterior, here's posterior. What lobe would be back over here? Ah, it's labeled too bad. Occipital lobe, and then here is the parietal lobe, and then here is the frontal. Okay, and then off to the side, there's going to be another lobe called the temporal lobe, right underneath the temporal bone. All right, now, do you see any convolutions on this brain? Yes, significant and deep. It's really hard to miss them. So here is the separation between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. And so we call this thing the central sulcus. Remember, the depression is a sulcus. And I see a gyrus right in front of it. We call that the precentral gyrus. And then right behind it is the, take a guess, it's a gyrus. If this is the precentral, this is the postcentral gyrus. They have different functions. Maybe I'll talk about it right now since we're on this slide. Okay, so here's the two frontal lobes, right? You see the two cerebral hemispheres. And the frontal lobe has a number of functions, but especially this precentral gyrus. There's something that you have in your car that's in the front. What do you have in the front of your car? Just like you have this gyrus in the front of your brain. What do you have in the front of your car? You got to check the oil in it. Yeah, you have a motor. Okay, and the motor makes you go, right? That's what a motor does. Well, this precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex. This is the area that can stimulate skeletal muscle movement. So every time you're voluntarily moving a muscle, those impulses are generated by this particular gyrus. So if somebody has a stroke and part of the gyrus dies, guess what will happen to that person? What will happen to a person if somebody has a stroke in the precentral gyrus? They won't be able to move some part of their body. Okay? Then that's a common feature. This postcentral gyrus over here is not motor, but this is sensory on the surface of your body. Right? So remember, the precentral is motor because you have the motor in your car in the front. This postcentral is not motor, but it is, yeah, what's another name for sensory? Afferent, right? So afferent for the post, efferent for the precentral. And so this is where you have sensation on the surface of your body. So if you have a stroke in this part of the brain, what is going to be your deficit? Will you be able to move? Yes, you'll be able to move just fine, okay, but you won't get any sensation from that part of the body, pain, temperature, or nothing like that. It will just kind of feel all numb to you as a result. Okay, and then occipital lobe, we already said that was for vision. All right, I need a nice temporal lobe, all right next to it. Okay, so here is the cerebrum, and we're just looking at the cortex, right? Here's the cerebellum, here's the brainstem, here's the pons. And here is the temporal lobe. So we got occipital lobe, temporal lobe, and then what lobe is this right here? This is the parietal lobe, and here is the frontal lobe. So if you're going to assign one function to the frontal lobe, what would you assign the function of the frontal lobe to be? I would say motor, right? Like moving parts of your body. What about the parietal lobe? That would be sensation, general sensation on the surface of your body. What about occipital lobe? Sensation once again, but in particular, vision, right? And the temporal lobe, right about in this area, right here, this is where your primary auditory cortex is. So temporal lobe, at least in this area right here, also is for sensation, okay, but in particular hearing. Okay. Well, what did we say about the frontal lobe? Motor areas. One particular really important motor area is what we call Broca's area. I want to find a picture of Broca's area. Broca's area maybe on this right here. Not really. Close, but not quite. Is that where I was? That's where I was. Well, here's an illustration that nicely shows occipital, temporal, parietal, frontal. Here's that central sulcus that we were talking about. Gray matter on the surface of the brain, white matter that is deep. But I want to find another fantastic slide. Okay, here it is. Can you pick out the different lobes? Like, what part of the brain is this right here? This is not a lobe. It's not part of the cerebrum. This is the brainstem, and in particular, what piece of the brainstem is this? Spinal cord is right about here. That's the medulla oblongata, and then we have the pons, okay? And the pons can send signals into the cerebellum via what kind of thing? That weird naming structure, that is a peduncle, right? A cerebellar peduncle. And then I see the cerebrum, right? And I can see all the convolutions. So here is the occipital lobe for vision. Here's temporal lobe right here for hearing. And then the postcentral gyrus is for what we call somatosensory, primary somatosensory gyrus, because that means on the surface of your body. Somatic means not in a deep body cavity, but more on the surface, like skeletal muscle. Okay, and other receptors you have on the surface of your body. And then frontal lobe, in particular, the pre-central gyrus, that is your primary motor cortex. And there's some other association areas. So here's the primary visual cortex. And then as signals are shared to different parts of the occipital lobe, we call these association areas. So the primary visual cortex, you might see maybe differences in gray. You might see different kinds of colors. You might be able to just barely recognize a pattern. And then that information is shared with the association areas. And then you'll be able to more clearly define what those patterns are and maybe even what the meaning of those patterns. Like, what pattern do I see right here? I see black and white. I see letters, right? And then letters are used to form words, right? So that is what's happening, okay, in these association areas. Okay, now Broca's area. Where did we say, what's the motor cortex? Frontal. So getting back to Broca's area, that's the motor area for speech in particular. All right, and we can see it right here. That's an association area. So that association area will work with the primary motor cortex for you to move your tongue and your lips and breathing so that you can speak, so that you can pronounce words properly. All right, so that's the that's Broca's area. So what else is there besides speaking in terms of language? There are two parts to language. There's speaking language, but also what? Writing is pretty good speaking, but that's motor. Writing is still motor, speaking is motor. I'm thinking of comprehending language, right? Hearing language, right? So that's not a motor function, that is a sensory function. And here is that area, it's called Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area gets information from the primary auditory cortex, sends signals in here. The primary visual cortex sends signals in here. And so this is the area for understanding language. But language is also important because of what you see, like facial expression, maybe hand gestures, not just purely auditory information. So this is that special association area for language. Okay, so what do we have right here? Wernicke's area, occipital lobe, visual, temporal lobe, for hearing, and also olfactory areas. What is the sense of olfaction? Smell, that's right. Parietal lobe, for somatosensation on the surface of your body, like pressure, pain, temperature, parietal lobe. Okay, I want to go back to this frontal lobe, because here I see what your book calls basal ganglia. But by a modern definition, what is a ganglion, once again? What's a ganglion? Group of nerve cell bodies, and where do you find them? In the peripheral nervous system, right? But we're looking at the frontal lobe, and is frontal lobe peripheral nervous system? It's not. It is central nervous system. So by modern nomenclature, what would we want to call a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system, or the brain, for instance? We want to call that a nucleus, right? So the basal ganglia, what people call these things for years and years and years, now are called basal nuclei, and you should probably start to call them that too, even though your book still calls them ganglia. All right, so what the heck are these? Let's find out where they're located first. Okay, where are these basal nuclei located? All right, so now what kind of section are we looking at here? That's a pretty good section, transverse section. So I see gray matter in the cerebral cortex, right? I see a lot of convolutions. Then I see white matter, right, in the interior part of the hemisphere. So this white matter, what would be a good way for you to think of this white matter? Myelinated tracts, right? Taking information from one place in the brain to another. But now, do we have tracts in this dark area right here? We do not, right? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And I can see a number of them, like the putamen, globus pallidus, okay, caudate. And here's the caudate nucleus. These things are what we call the basal nuclei. Your book calls basal ganglia. These things are very important in fine controls of motor movement. So when I reach out to get a cup of coffee or something, my motion is really nice and fluid, right? And it stops right where my hand should be, right? And that's because there are centers right here that inhibit, for instance, when I'm reaching out, my triceps is the muscle that's doing most of the work, will inhibit the triceps just a little bit, but allow that motion to be very nice and fluid. If there is degeneration in these areas right here, then somebody's motion is going to be very staggered. They won't have smooth motion, and their motion will be really difficult, because as I reach out and contract my triceps, my biceps is not going to relax. So those antagonistic muscles will be fighting each other. So there can be degeneration of the basal nuclei in Parkinson's disease. That's how we understand the anatomical significance of Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's disease, sometimes substance abusers, when they take certain kinds of chemicals, will poison these various areas. Substance abusers then can have like a premature Parkinson's disease as a result of that. You know any actors that have Parkinson's disease? I heard the right answer. Michael J. Fox. Anybody know Michael J. Fox? Probably. He's still around. He has Parkinson's disease, which was a very early onset, right? Very atypical. He was a very young person, a young actor when it first started. And so what did everybody say? That he was a substance abuser, right? But he was very adamant and said, I never abused any substances when I was growing up or acting. And everybody's kind of scratching their head until a number of child actors in, what was the name of the show, Family Ties? Is that the name of the show that he was in with some other younger actors? A number of people that were in that TV show also came down with an early onset Parkinson's disease. And what people are thinking now, okay, is a result of that filming production schedule. How is a production schedule? Well, you stay up for 12, 24 hours shooting while all the camera people there and light people are there. And to get people awake for that long a period of time, especially when they're being filmed, they're given, maybe even secretly, amphetamines and other kinds of stimulants. And so now somebody is just suspecting that all those child actors got a drink that was laced with some kind of illicit drug to keep them awake and very active during filming. But the downside was, what? That it poisoned their basal nuclei as a result. That was really unfortunate that happened. And we can see that that's a progressive condition. The frontal lobe, well, here's one other thing. Besides for coordinating muscle movement, for initiating muscle movement, it's also for cognition. Right, cognition is thinking. Cognition also has to do with understanding your surroundings, proper social behavior, depending on what your surroundings are, and just understanding proper behavior. So if there's a lesion in the frontal lobe, then somebody might start acting very inappropriately, depending on the circumstances that they find themselves in. And maybe, has anybody taken a psychology class? There's a very interesting case that really underscores that. Who can tell me about that really interesting case that you talk about in psychology classes? Anybody? Where there's damage to somebody's frontal lobe? Phineas Gage, that's right. That's the person's name. And he was working on a railroad. He was a railroad worker. And he was clearing a path through some mountainside or rocks to put the railway tracks down. And so they had to drill a hole, all right, and they fill it with dynamite to blow it up. And to pack the dynamite down, they use this big metal rod. And he was packing the dynamite down, and guess what happened to the dynamite? It exploded. Well, he can't hold on to the rod when that happens, and it shot up right out of the hole, and it went in, okay, underneath his mandible, and through his out the top of his head, okay, right through his frontal lobe. But he survived that. It wasn't a fatal injury, but that knocked out enough of the frontal lobe that his personality changed completely, to where before the accident, he showed up to work on time, did all of his homework assignments. Just kidding, I don't think he had homework, okay? But was very appropriate with fellow workers and his supervisors. But after that accident, guess what? He was hard to find, never showed up to work on time, late, was argumentative, didn't like to follow instructions. So it was like two different people, right? So the frontal lobe is important in that respect. So I should put down Phineas Gage. You can do a Google on Phineas Gage. Okay. Maybe one last slide I want to show you. One last slide. If I can find it. Oh, good. Okay, here we have now, what kind of section is this? Is a nice coronal or frontal section. And I can see some dark areas inside the brain. What are these dark areas once again? The basal nuclei, or even though your book says ganglia, you should call them nuclei. And then you see these different white areas, right? And we said white areas are myelinated axons, or groups of them going carrying information someplace, right? So here are some tracts that start in the cerebral cortex, and then they descend, right, down into the spinal cord. So what do we call these descending tracts? Are they motor or sensory? Descending are, they're starting in central nervous system, going out to the periphery. Those are motor or efferent. Okay. So these efferent signals are moving between the basal nuclei, and this white area right here has got a nice name. It's called the internal capsule. That's a nice landmark. Internal capsule is what kind of information once again? Efferent tracts going down to the periphery. That's what we call a projection fiber. Projection fibers take information from a superior part of the brain to an inferior, or from an inferior to a superior part. I mean, not just brain, but central nervous system. So it could be spinal cord and brain, or even between different parts of the brain, right? So that's a projection fiber. And these projection fibers just happen to be going through the internal capsule. Oh, look, you can see the internal capsule here really nice on this picture. Okay. Here is a big separation between the right and left hemispheres. This is called a fissure, and we call it the longitudinal fissure. Longitudinal separates right and left hemispheres. So if there are electrical impulses in the right side of the brain, they can't get to the left side. The right side of the brain doesn't know what the left side is thinking unless signals can get there. And there is a way, and that is through this right here. This is what we call the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum has what we call commissural fibers. So a commissural fiber shares information from the right and left sides of the central nervous system. It's a commissural fiber. Then we have one last kind of tract. I see it going from one gyrus going to a neighboring gyrus. And it can be kind of far away, but it's got to be on the same side of the central nervous system, right? And if it's on the same side, that's what we call association fibers or tracts. So projection tracts go up and down, commissural tracts go right to left, association just stay in the same part of the brain. Okay, they don't go really up or down, they just stay in this local neighborhood, and they certainly don't go from right to left. So those are three important kinds of tracts. And a tract, of course, is, what kind of matter is a tract? It is, we see it right here, white matter, which means what? Not nerve cell bodies, axons that are myelinated. Okay, well that's a little bit of an introduction to central nervous system. And next time we'll carry on, we'll start to look at the cerebellum. And then spinal cord. Sign and sheet is going around.